upcoming Federal Facilities Online Academy, the role of Superfund performance measures. We're going to be joined by four presenters today. Emmy Laha from EPA's Federal Facilities and Restoration Reuse Office is continuing on with today's series. She's an environmental scientist who works on Superfund cleanups at hazardous waste sites through the EPA Federal Facility and Restoration Reuse Office here in Washington, D.C. She works on implementing national policy, promoting consistency in cleanups, developing training, and developing relationships in other federal agencies and stakeholders. We'll also be joined by Boone O'Neill. Boone is coming from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, where he works as a program analyst in the Budget Planning and Evaluation Branch and is the designated Environmental Indicator Coordinator for that office here in Washington, D.C. He has responsibility of coordinating with EPA's 10 regions to ensure consistency and accuracy in reporting human exposure and groundwater migration details on all National Priority List or NPL sites to the public. We'll also be joined by John Burchett, again, from EPA's Federal Facilities and Restoration Reuse Office, where he is a physical scientist. And he has a background in earth science and environmental and geosciences. He has some private sector experience as an environmental consultant, and John has also worked as a remedial project manager overseeing NPLs and BRAC, or BRAC, federal facility sites in EPA Region 8 for a number of years before joining the FFRO, or Federal Facilities Office here at EPA, where he is a lead point of contact for work planning and program measures. And then lastly, we'll also be joined by Jim Farah from Ohio EPA, where he has worked for many years. Also, he was in the private consulting sector, specializing in human health and ecological risk assessments. And then over at Ohio EPA, he has worked as a frontline hazardous waste inspector and risk assessor for RCRA closure corrective actions. And he's also worked in other management positions and is a chief there in the Southeast District and has helped coordinate all Ohio EPA divisions as well as overseeing numerous programs there with CERCLA, RCRA C, voluntary action programs, and brownfields. So with that brief introduction to our presenters, we're going to call up some opening materials about the seminar series, and I'll turn over to Emmy to provide some background to the audience on the sessions in the series. Emmy?
Sure. So I just want to take a minute or two to talk about the Federal Facilities Academy. So it's a voluntary training program. It was developed primarily for EPA RPMs and other project managers from federal agencies and state governments, as well as tribal groups who work on Superfund cleanups at federal facility sites. And the intent of these trainings were really to help supplement some of our other EPA trainings that may not focus specifically on some of the nuances of federal facility cleanup. So we're hoping that these 11 webinars can shed more light on the challenges that we face. And then there's also a one-day in-person course that is getting rescheduled now with everything that's currently going on. Hopefully we'll have new dates soon on the availability of that course. Again, completely voluntary, but really geared to help you get more honed in on the challenges we face at federal facility sites.
Okay. Thanks, Emmy. Yep. So just a quick reminder, in terms of participation and credit, so as Emmy was highlighting, this entire series of courses is a combination of 11 online webinars and one in-person classroom delivery. The 11 online webinars are open to the public. They can be taken online, live, or you can replay them online on demand. Regardless of how you participate with the online deliveries for the 11 webinars, you can provide a participation certificate for each session in the series upon submitting feedback. So again, if you're here live, you share feedback, you can get a certificate. If you replay the recorded version and submit feedback, you can still get a certificate. So you can mix and match your participation through any combination of live and replay of the recorded versions. For the in-person classroom delivery, that you must attend in person, but as Emmy has mentioned, they are working on rescheduling that delivery. If you would like to get an Academy certificate, which will document your attendance in all of the webinars, as well as that in-person delivery, you need to complete all of the online sessions, have certificates for all 11 webinars, and then again, attend that in-person classroom training to get the Academy certificate. Please know that the in-person training will have a limited audience, meaning that it's not open to the general public. It'll be limited to EPA, states, tribes, and other federal agencies. But we'll share additional details about the rescheduled delivery as it becomes available for that classroom training. Okay. So with that brief introduction, Emmy, let's go ahead and call up the presentation materials and get started with our session. And I apologize, we'll get you to that starting slide.
Great. Well, while that's loading up, I just want to say thank you for joining us today. This course is looking at performance measures and environmental indicators. And I'll just clarify, this isn't only for federal facility sites. A lot of what we're going to discuss today applies to all of our Superfund cleanups. So good information. We're excited to be bringing this to you today. But before we dive into the content, we wanted to get a better idea of who's joining us today. So we have a group poll for you all to give us a little bit of information about yourselves and where you're coming from. We'd like to ask, what experience, if any, have you had with determining environmental indicators at your federal facility site? Jean, can you lead the group through the poll?
Absolutely. So in the lower left corner of everyone's screen, there's now a new dialog box that has appeared where you can enter your own response to the above question. Again, what experience, if any, have you had with determining EIs at your federal facility sites? You'll enter your response at the bottom box, and when done, hit the Enter or Send button. Upon other people submitting answers, you'll start to see them queue up in the window above. You can review what others have entered and actually agree or vote if you also have shared those experiences. So I encourage you to browse through what others have submitted, and if you find something that rings true on your end, for example, in my case, I have no experience, you can hover your cursor over that answer, and a plus one icon will appear on the right. And you can click that plus one to cast a vote or agree with that entry. And the list will automatically populate the most popular options at the top. So as I can see already, Emmy, it looks like a lot of people have very limited or no experience with this at all. But some have multiple years, as I scroll through that list, and are seasoned veterans working with environmental indicators. But I think from what I'm seeing here as these answers are sort of sorting themselves out, the bulk of the audience has very limited experience in this arena.
Okay. Well, I'm actually not surprised to hear that response that there are a lot of people who have limited experience. At least for me personally, in doing environmental indicators at a federal facility, it was usually done very internal to EPA. I didn't typically participate in a conversation with the other federal agency. I would go through these flowcharts, which we'll discuss later today, make the determination, and submit that into the appropriate database for collection into EPA's overall tracking. So hearing people say, oh, I haven't really been exposed to this, I could totally see that, but I'm hoping that once you learn more about what we have in today's webinar and the opportunity to engage in conversations with your site teams, that you'll all be better prepared to discuss those topics, particularly if there's a challenging situation emerging at your site. So thank you so much for giving us a little bit of an idea of who we're dealing with on the phone lines today. So that's very helpful. But right now, I'm going to hand it over to John Furchett to get started with our slide content.
Thanks, Emmy. So on the screen, you guys should be able to see the topics we're going to go through over the course of this presentation. I'll kick things off with performance measures and targets. We'll go into environmental indicators, and then some other circular components, and then guidance and tools. Okay, slide 4, performance measures. Again, I'll kick things off, and as Jean mentioned, I've been doing performance measures here at EPA headquarters for about 5 years now, and previous to that, I was an RPM in Region 3 for 7 years. Next slide. Oops, looks like it went one too far, okay. So in this section of the webinar, I'll discuss the Government Performance and Results Act, or GPRA, and later the modernization of this act. I'll also touch a little bit on our Superfund Enterprise Management Systems, And just briefly on environmental indicators before we get into a more in-depth discussion about EIs. So what is GPRA? GPRA originated in 1993 and required federal agencies to develop results-oriented and outcome-related goals. These goals align with annual plans, budgets, and long-term plans and outcomes through the multi-year agency-specific strategic plans. And some of the key components of GPRA are the five-year strategic plans, the annual performance plans, and the annual reporting of successes and failures in meeting targets. And the last thing I'll point out is that GPRA was modernized in 2010 by the Government Performance Results Modernization Act, which requires that the agency's progress be tracked via annual performance measures, which are presented in EPA's annual performance plans and budgets. The primary goal of GPRA is the framework it provides for the agencies to develop strategic plans. EPA's strategic plan is published every 4 years and describes the agency's long-term direction and strategy to achieve them. We in Superfund support Goal 1, Objective 1.3 of revitalizing land and preventing contamination. The Superfund remedial program tracks 6 measures, which are then reported to Congress. One of the key reasons measures are important is they are linked to our budget requests and how much money is needed to complete the anticipated work. We as an agency commit to accomplishing these measures annually through the Congressional Justification, or CJ. So what are these measures? And I pulled them up on the screen here. You should be able to see them. Number 1, remedial site assessments completed. Number 2, human exposure under control. Number 3, site-wide ready for anticipated use. Number 4, remedial action project completion. Number 5, groundwater migration under control. And number 6, construction completion. And the 2 environmental indicators we'll talk about in a little more depth later on. But the one thing I did want to point out is that for federal facilities, many of these site-wide measures can be difficult to accomplish. For those of you that are familiar with the program, and if you're not, many of these federal facilities are very large installations, 50,000 acres plus in some cases. We have many operable units. And if you have just one of those 30 or so operable units where human exposure is not controlled, that entire facility will be listed as human exposure not controlled since it's a base-wide measure. And that generally applies to construction completion, SWARU, and groundwater migration as well. EPA's planning information is tracked in our Superfund Enterprise Management Systems. And for those of you that have been around the agency for a while, you may remember CERCLIS, and SIMS has since replaced CERCLIS. I believe that happened in 2012 or so. So SIMS is basically a data warehouse where we plan out the CERCLA pipeline. So your RIFS starts and completions, your RDs, your RAs, your 5-year reviews, and so on are tracked in SIMS. And the one thing I do want to point out is, you know, I know SEMS, the SEMS end of things and tracking the info isn't the fun part of a job as an RPM, but it's very important. This information is publicly available. It's on our site profile pages, and people look at it. So it's really important that EPA works with our states and federal partners to plan these sites to completion the best that we can. And we use the Superfund Enterprise Management Systems to do that. So you've also probably heard of some other things being measured at the agency, and some of those have come about either through the Environmental Lean Management Systems or the Superfund Task Force. And specifically, recommendation 1 of the Superfund Task Force is to target NPL sites that are not showing sufficient progress towards site cleanup completions, and directed the program to determine any sites where human exposure is not under control and to prioritize bringing those sites under control. The Federal Facilities National Program does have 7 sites that are listed as human exposure not controlled, and there are also several human exposure insufficient data sites. And I think many of you know, the folks that are familiar with the program, emerging contaminants, you know, they can present a challenge to the program. We've run into some challenges with respect to PFAS and some others that have caused some of these environmental indicators to flip. In response to the task force recommendation, a publicly accessible EI human exposure dashboard was launched in January 2018. It provides both background information on the HEEI and site-specific information. Although we're speaking here specifically to federal facilities, this dashboard presents information on both federal facility and private Superfund sites. And here's a screenshot of the dashboard, and as you can see, it presents information from the site name, the HE status, and the status description. Now, the HE statuses are developed by the RPMs in the regions and then uploaded to SEMS. And one thing I would like to point out about this, you know, I talked a little bit earlier about the number of operable units and the complexity of the federal facility site. I think it's really important that folks utilize these descriptions to really highlight exactly what's going on at the site. So again, for example, if you have, you know, 30 operable units at your site and human exposure is controlled at 29 of them, this is really an opportunity to highlight that, you know, 29 of those operable units have human exposure controlled. However, you do have one operable unit where groundwater migration is causing an off-base issue, or you have vapor intrusion or something like that. So definitely utilize these to really get your story out there, because again, this information is available to the public. And with that, I'll take any questions, and if there are no questions, I will kick it over to Jim to go through environmental indicators.
Okay. I'll just remind the audience, remember, you can submit your questions using that Q&A window in the lower corner at any point. John, I don't see any right now in the queue, so I think perhaps just in the interest of time, maybe we'll move on, but if other questions do come in, we can always come back to them in a later segment.
Sounds good.
Great. Thanks, Amy. This is Jim Sparrow with Ohio EPA, and let me click this so my screen is showing. I'll try to run out of slides before you all run out of interest here. And what just happened to this? Sorry, I mean, my slide just disappeared. Okay. If somebody would click the slides when I indicate. I'm Jim Sparrow with Ohio EPA. I'll give a perspective on environmental indicators and their use in RCRA and in Ohio, particularly as related to the RCRA GPRA 2020 goals. Before I get into the slides that I do have, I want to talk a little bit about RCRA facility investigation remedy selection track. It was a lean event that Regions 3 and 7 did to try to figure out why investigations to remedy selection take so long in RCRA corrective action. We followed suit and were the first state in the region to do the lean event as well. And our data in Ohio matched up with Region 3 and 7's timeframes. In Ohio, our corrective action timeframes from site investigation to remedy selection, meat and potatoes was under the bell curve of 15 to 20 years. Some cases took a lot longer, and we had a few cases that we were able to get through in relatively short times. But still, 15 to 20 years is a fair amount of time to get to remedy selection. The RCRA FIRST is what the acronym comes out to, identified three main impediments that were a surprise to pretty much no one as to what took so long, and those three main impediments to progress at corrective action sites were lack of common goals, a lack of issue elevation. I'm talking about issues at the lower level, not the issues that rise up to dispute resolution and involve attorneys and those things. But I'm talking about, you know, field level decisions. Sometimes get strung out a little bit longer than they otherwise would if not for elevating them up the chain on wherever it might be stuck. And the third main impediment was money. You know, we can certainly work on the first two at the state level, common goals and issue elevation. You know, money is always a challenge at these corrective action sites, and CERCLA sites as well. So we implement the RCRA first concepts at sites in Ohio with a reasonable success, and I really think that those concepts fit in nicely with the environmental indicator goals that were came about back with the GPRA of 1993. Next slide, please. Environmental indicators, they're designed to communicate tangible progress is made in protecting human health and the environment. Rather than having a big graph of one, we got to one remedy selection each year. We can show that we are making progress along the way at each of these sites. The focus in RCRA was on these two, human health exposure and contaminated groundwater migration under control. And again, like was stated previously, these are site-wide measures that we want to see the entire site meeting both of those goals to meet the EI. Slide 16, please. So the GPRA of 1993, it preceded me by a number of years. Speculating, but I'm guessing it was recognized that the time frames to get a site from investigation to remedy selection just was a long time, and it was progress was being made, but how are you able to document the changes to the site are being conducted? And so meeting these goals was a way to demonstrate progress at these high priority sites where in many cases remedies were years off. So in Ohio, we're a federally delegated state for the RCRA program. So those federal goals for US EPA for RCRA became our goals in Ohio. So I will say at the state level, with these goals, it did focus us and it increased a sense of urgency, ownership, and accountability, I think at both the state and at the regulated entities. Not always, but I do think that it did provide a compass point that we would, that directed some of our work and aim towards accomplishments where things seemed pretty far off. Many corporations, I believe, took it to heart to meet these goals, and it sparked, you know, some cooperation to meet those goals. We found, you know, some corporations really wanted to show progress and wanted to be able to say, yes, we're meeting those environmental indicators. Slide 17, please. So how did we get these, you know, lists of sites for the GPRA 2020 that we were focused on in RCRA? So back in 1991, US EPA ranked facilities and established a baseline of projects for the GPRA. So, back in 91, they ranked all of RCRA corrective action sites high, medium, or low based on contaminated media, soil, groundwater, air, surface water. And from that ranking, they chose sites for the baseline for the environmental indicators. There were probably a few hits and misses with the list that were on the baseline, and we were allowed to make a few changes along the way. But I can tell you, US EPA didn't pick easy sites for the 2020 baseline. So next slide, slide 18, please. So the RCRA Corrective Action Program, the 2018, we found the 2018 accomplishments online. I don't think they had tallied the 2019 accomplishments yet. There are about 3,800 sites on the GPRA nationwide baseline. 95% of those met human exposures under control. 89% met migration and contaminated groundwater under control. 70% of those met the final remedy construction, and 36% met performance standards attained, sort of the end of the corrective action process. So how did we do? I think overall we did pretty good. Ohio's numbers matched up fairly close with the national numbers. I think we were at 90% right around 90% human health exposures under control and groundwater migration under control. We had, I want to say, close to 180 sites on our obligations for the GPRA 2020. I think that these goals really did spur the states and industry to achieve various milestones. We are in discussions with Region 5, being here in Ohio, on you know, beyond 2020. US EPA has recently, on the RCRA side, been focused on, not recently, but is focusing on ready for anticipated use as another marker for documenting progress at these sites. Slide 19, please. So we do have some guidance that are linked to in the notes section of this presentation. I kind of want to close out my part of this discussion saying I was probably a skeptic at the outside of this path that we went down, but we did keep at it, and we saw a few side benefits. One, I think, and you'll hear me say this a lot, is agency and industry engagement. People started talking to one another, I think relationships were built. I think that was probably one of the biggest things that came out of this, where we weren't talking because we didn't have interim goals to meet between, you know, the various steps of the corrective action process. This gave us a reason to talk, gave us a reason to keep things moving. And two, it forced us to focus on common goals, which I think gets back to, you know, one of the first things I said at the start of my discussion. I think that really helped. So, and third, I think that both the agency and industry were glad to be able to show progress at these sites rather than, you know, facility investigation and then not having a clear marker to show progress up until, you know, remedy selection or whatnot. I know I'm overstating it a little bit, but I think being able to show that progress was really important. And I can't necessarily prove it at this point, but I do think that the focus of the environmental indicators helped us shorten the time frames on at least some of the projects that we worked on. And with that, that's the end of my slides. I think we're going to pause for questions.
Yeah, we actually received a few questions that have come in. And so I'll start with this one, James, but feel free to let me know if we can expand this one. So one of the attendees was looking for a specific example of an EI.
This is Emmy. I guess we are going to talk specifically about what environmental indicator statuses are for both human exposure and groundwater in the upcoming slides in a great amount of detail. So I think that'll get answered soon.
Okay. All right. And then likewise, there are some follow-on questions about the phrase under control. Should we hold off on that one until we go through that content?
I think so. I think we'll make it very clear what that means. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's covered in the upcoming slides, and we knew those two questions were going to come.
All right, excellent. Well, this next question, someone would like to know, has the set of indicators been customized for state use in Ohio? They're asking, is the training localized in some way?
No, all of the environmental indicators that we use that I was speaking to on RCRA, what we're doing in Ohio is the same thing that Region 5 was doing in Chicago. So they, Region 5 had responsibility for some corrective action sites in Ohio, and we were following the same guidance and the same training. About the only thing that might have been different was the fact that we did that RCRA first lean event on our RCRA corrective action process in Ohio to try to figure out how to streamline what we're doing, but guidance documents and you know, all the regulatory documents are the same between us and the feds.
Okay. All right, great. I don't see any other questions, so I think we can go ahead and carry on at this point in time with the next segment in the training.
All right.
So good afternoon, everybody. My name is Boone O'Neill, and as we said earlier, I am the Environmental Indicator Coordinator for the Office of Superfund Remediation Technology and Innovation, which might be the longest acronym at EPA. So Jim gave a good overview of what the EIs are, and so now we're going to dive into the specifics of how we use the human exposure indicator specifically. So when we talk about designating a site with a certain human exposure status, we use the term human exposure determination. And what we're ultimately striving for here is a status or a determination of human exposure under control. And we'll discuss what has to happen for this to occur. But basically, the idea is that there must be no unacceptable complete exposure pathways between human health receptors and toxic substances. So we can make this kind of positive determination by first gathering information about those unacceptable pathways, and then by taking steps to eliminate or mitigate those pathways, or simply by confirming that none exists in the first place. It's important to consider new information that arises continuously throughout the cleanup process, because this site-wide status can change, and it often does over time. And it's also important to note that a determination must be made with reasonable certainty, and it must be documented at some point in the cleanup process. Let me move this green arrow out of the way here. So here's a good overview of what these status types are for human exposure. And these are not necessarily a chronological order. For example, if a site has human exposure insufficient data, it doesn't have to change to the next status type of not controlled. After that, it can actually go straight to human exposure under controlled if the data suggests that there are no pathways. But we wanted to give you kind of an overview of what these status types are, and we're going to talk about each of these individually. So we'll start with the most basic human exposure status, and that's HEID, or human exposure insufficient data. And in my opinion, this is the trickiest status to understand because it seems so simple. It's essentially saying we lack information to determine whether people have the potential to be exposed. But we have several things to evaluate here. So we first need to collect information to characterize all potential exposure pathways. And this typically happens during the initial phases of the cleanup, or the RIFS phase, that's remedial investigation and feasibility study. And if after that process we haven't identified any exposure pathways, then we could go ahead and designate that site as human exposure under control. But if we do find exposure pathways, we need to next identify if they're completed and if the exposure itself rises above an unacceptable human health threshold. And this happens after a risk assessment is completed, and that happens for every site whenever there's a new pathway that has been identified. And furthermore, the exposure pathways, if they're not complete, need to be reasonably anticipated rather than theoretical, because it has to be based on current use of the site and not future use. So this kind of gets us into a gray area where the RPMs, the remedial program managers, need to use their best judgment in making a determination so that we can convey the most accurate information possible to the public. And again, it's worth bringing up that if a site is currently designated as under control and new information surfaces that suggests that there's a new pathway emerging, we need to consider changing the status back to human exposure insufficient data until we can investigate those new pathways. So when we use this specific designation, HEID, we need to set a date for when we expect to have sufficient data to make a determination. And we need to detail what we're going to do to gather that information. So that was a lot of details about insufficient data. So we want to open it up to a polling question to see how well people are understanding this so far. So let's first try to answer that first question there. And I'll turn it over to Jean to kind of moderate the responses here.
Okay. So again, in the lower right, left corner, pardon me, you'll now see a poll question where you can respond to the very first question up on slide 24. What is your human exposure status determination? You'll see a number of options labeled A through E, and you'll be able to click the circle to the left of the answer that you think is correct in this situation. So I'll encourage you to just read through that statement that soil and groundwater samples have been collected at Site X as part of the remedial investigation, and data suggests that there are no existing pathways for human exposure. So you'll want to answer, what is your human exposure status determination? For anyone who's on a mobile device, you don't have to worry if you can't see that. You can type an answer into the Q&A window. But there's no submit button on the poll window. You just click the circle to the left of the answer that you think is accurate. And so in giving you all a few seconds, so Boone, I'm going to turn on a quick broadcast mode here, and it looks like about half of the audience think that the answer is C, about a third is selecting B, and then the remainders are split between option A and option E. And the answer is? Boone, did you
want to
turn
it over to me now,
Jean? Yeah, to talk to you the correct
answer,
okay. Yes.
All right, so everyone, the answer is C, current human exposure is under control. And so the language in this example is suggestive. It says that we've gathered data, and that data is sufficient to allow us to make a determination, and it doesn't show that there's any potential pathways. So based on that data, we can go ahead and categorize the site as human exposure under control, HEUC. So now we're going to, well, first of all, before we go to the second question, does anyone have any questions about that? Because I want to make sure that's, that everyone understands why it's HEUC rather than the other options.
Hey, Boone, this is Emmy. Go ahead, Jean.
We did have someone who was asking about how long you had to collect data for an HEID.
Mm-hmm.
Determination.
So that
I don't know if you can answer
that. That really depends on the site, and it depends on the RPM, the remedial program manager. So, whenever you feel like every existing pathway has been thoroughly investigated, or every pathway that's known, and you have data to determine whether or not those pathways are completed. And that's about the time when you can say that you have gathered enough data to go ahead and make the determination based on what the data suggests. So in this case, it didn't expose any potential pathways. Hope that answers the question. Is there anything else before we move on to the next question?
Just that a few people thought that they had to answer the bottom question on the slide. They didn't realize that they were answering this one. So we're starting up here, ladies and gentlemen, and then we'll move down to this one. But someone did have a clarifying statement here that if the CSM shows vapor intrusion as a pathway and there is no data yet for that, should we conclude that it's all under control?
Well, so
right.
You need to have data that thoroughly describes the threat of the pathway, not simply that the pathway exists. And so if you need more information about the vapor intrusion to determine whether or not that particular intrusion rises above an unacceptable threshold or whether or not that exposure is completed to human receptors, then you need to continue to gather that data and keep the site in human exposure insufficient data, HEID, until you feel like you have enough data to answer those bigger questions of whether or not it's completed or whether or not it's an unacceptable threat. And we're going to continue to discuss this, and vapor intrusion is a pretty tricky pathway in particular. We're going to continue to discuss this in the following slides.
And this is Emmy. I just wanted to chime in that these apply your understandings are a bit open-ended, and it's great to hear people asking, well, what about this or what about that, because that really is the intent. We realize there's, I mean, very simplified representation here with these mini quizzes, if you want to call them that, but it's great that people are already beginning to connect the dots to say, oh, well, maybe I needed more data. Maybe I needed more than just soil and groundwater samples. What else does my CSM say? Those are great questions to be thinking about.
Yeah, thanks, Emmy. That is a good point. Jean, could we potentially clear the polls and try to answer the second part? And we might have had some spoilers here in the discussion.
That's right. But again, now we can look at that second question on the slide. And now with that additional data that suggests that vapor intrusion may be occurring in on-site buildings, what is your updated human exposure status? Is it A, B, C, D, or E? All right. And here we seem to get a lot of central answers really targeting on one particular reply. So let's go ahead and take a look at how the audience has voted, and it looks like almost 85% of you are picking option B, with a handful of votes for option A, and then one or two for option C. So Boone, with this additional data, what would the answer be?
Right, so I think everyone got this correct for the most part. If there's vapor intrusion on site, but you don't quite know, as we discussed, if you don't quite know if it's completed, or if it rises above an unacceptable threshold, then you need to keep the site as HEID, because nothing in this description suggests that that it's definitely occurring, that it's completed, or that it's unacceptable. It simply says may be occurring. So that may be language is indicative of further data that's needed before you can make the determination. Are there any questions about that?
Okay. We just had a comment about emerging contaminants. And so there are some concerns or questions when we have an emerging contaminant like PFAS. When would that status change to an HEID?
Right. That is a hot topic these days, and I believe Emmy is going to cover that in pretty good detail later on in the presentation, if we could hold off on that discussion.
All right. Well, then I think in the interest of time, let's carry on.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for indulging us in this pop quiz. Let's see here. My screen is not dealing with me. Okay. So now we're going to move to discuss the next status of human exposure not under control. And hopefully our discussion on the HEID kind of highlights the things that constitute a determination of not controlled. So just to be clear, there needs to be an unacceptable and completed pathway when pathways are reasonably anticipated to be completed or unacceptable. And this status is also, just like all the statuses for human exposure, it is a site-wide designation. So even if one OU is the outstanding problem, the entire site still has to fit the status that applies to that one OU that's the problem. And just as we need to have a date for when we expect to have sufficient data for HEID, in this case, we need to set a date for when we expect the site to come under control, or when we expect it to become HEUC, when it's designated as not controlled. That's very important so that we can project when we expect to bring the site under control to mitigate all impact on human health. So we're going to continue with our pop quiz here. And there's just one question this time, but we specifically want to look at a kind of interesting example. So Jean's going to open that polling back up again. Let's see if we can identify the correct human exposure status for this situation.
All And so we're seeing those votes come in. Again, this time asking, is human exposure under control? I also have options A, B, C, D, and E below. And I'm starting to see some trends pop out in the responses. If I had Jeopardy theme song music, I would be playing it for you all right now. But we are seeing two answers kind of get the bulk of the votes. And I think what we'll go ahead and do is take a quick look at this distribution. So, Boone, it looks like about 45% of the audience thinks it is option A. About a third of the audience thinks that it's option C. And then the remainder is sort of torn between option B and option D. So, Boone, which is the right answer?
All right. So this one was a kind of a tricky question. The correct answer is actually C, human exposure under control. And that's because in this case, though the toxic substance has not been cleaned up, we have mitigated the pathway to human exposure by providing the bottled water. And so so we've kind of controlled the situation in that sense. So the correct answer is HEUC, human exposure under control. Does that make sense to everyone?
And we've had a few clarifying comments come in about aerosols from showering, or if the water is being used for bathing, and a number of other assumptions about other dermal exposure scenarios.
Yeah, so all of those kind of examples or situations that are outside the scope of this question could lead to a different designation, but going based off of the information that's provided strictly, it doesn't indicate there being any other potential completed pathways. The only pathway that there was the groundwater that was being consumed, and in this case it's no longer being consumed because we've mitigated that pathway by providing the bottled water. So just going based off of what is in the slide here, it's human exposure under control, but again, there could be other situations occurring which would lead us to have to rethink the status.
Yeah, this is Emmy just chiming in. That's great that people are thinking, oh, well, you know, if ingestion is the only pathway, is dermal contact another way that people could be exposed? Great, great questions. For the simplicity of this question, we're assuming it's only the ingestion as drinking water of this groundwater that would be an issue, and why we would go with human exposures under control for mitigating the pathway. But really great questions, because that could change what your determination would be.
Right. Thank you, Emmy. How about we move on in the sake of time and kind of circle back to the status of human exposure under control, which we've alluded to a lot. By now, it should be pretty apparent that this status is designated to sites where there are no unacceptable or complete pathways. And again, this status is a site-wide measure. So if there's one OU that's not under control, we can't designate it as under control. And this status can be given once sufficient data indicates that there are no pathways, or once we've taken steps to mitigate those pathways, like in the last example. It's also important to note here that this status occurs before a site becomes construction complete. And that leads us to our next status type, which is current human exposure under control and all protective remedies in place. And the acronym for that is HEPR. So this is a higher level of under control that also indicates that all construction is complete and exposure remedies are in place and functioning correctly to ensure that contaminants don't reach human exposure receptors. So sites that remain in this status after construction are completed typically also have ongoing long-term remediation actions or ongoing operation and maintenance as needed. And then the final status for human exposure is current human exposure under control and long-term human health protection achieved. And from that mouthful, we've given it the acronym of HHPA. And so this status is achieved once the site has become under control, all construction is completed, and once all human exposure cleanup goals have been achieved. And those cleanup goals include long-term soil, groundwater, or surface water restoration needs. And this status applies not just to NPL sites, but also to deleted sites, as well as sites that have reached that site completion status. So this is kind of the ultimate status that we're trying to get to that indicates that we've brought it under control, we've done all the construction, and we've completed all cleanup needs. So this is kind of the end result of a human exposure designation. So I know that we have covered a lot of information so far for the human exposure statuses, so I did want to open it up to any questions about any of the different status types.
Yeah, we had a few questions that came in about the, quote, unacceptable threshold. Is it 10 to the minus 6 or some range between 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 6?
Yeah, so there's specific guidance depending on the contaminant of concern, and that has to do, you know, with there's not really a blanket statement that I can give. It is one of those things that's really dependent on the kind of substance of concern, what the exposure pathways are, and what can be done to mitigate it. And so that's kind of an open-ended language that we've left up to the RPMs so that they have some flexibility in determining that status based off of the site conditions. But there is a specific guidance for what's considered unacceptable depending on the toxin of concern.
All right. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, Emmy.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to add, like, you'll hear we'll use the term unacceptable, that there's no unacceptable human exposure pathways or at unacceptable levels. So it does get to, well, what's acceptable? What is we're not saying it will be pristine. It's still under the Superfund cleanups of an acceptable risk range. So anything outside or beyond that risk range would be unacceptable, if that helps answer the question.
Okay, great.
Right, and again, I think I mentioned it briefly, but there is a risk assessment for each site and each pathway that's completed that takes into account these specific details that help you determine what that threshold of acceptability is.
Okay. Let's take two more questions. I think we've got time for those. Someone had asked, you had referenced guidance throughout this portion of the presentation, and they were wondering if you could clarify what guidance are you referencing?
Might have been for the guidance that I was just talking about for specific substances and what the acceptability threshold is.
Mm-hmm.
I've given my contact information. If anyone wants to reach out to me about specifics on that, I'd be happy to point you in the right direction after the presentation.
Okay, great. And we are getting a lot of clarification that a number of people are interested in documents on specific substances and their thresholds. So we'll remind everyone how they can reach out to Boone when we're done with the content today. And then just one other question here. Someone wanted to know, does that mean that HEPR, long-term well monitoring for PFOA or PFAS sites? And so this kid commented earlier.
I'm a bit confused. Could you clarify the question just a bit, Jean?
Well, all that I've got is, would that mean HEPR, long-term well monitoring for PFOA or PFAS sites? And so if the submitter wants to clarify, we might be able to circle back and come back if the context is missing.
Okay. So it would kind of depend on a couple things. So in the event of, and again, Emmy is going to discuss emerging contaminants specifically with PFOA and PFAS in a little while, but it is worth noting that if there is sufficient data that suggests that those contaminants are, you know, have provided a complete exposure pathway and that pathway is deemed unacceptable, and there's already information and data that suggest that and you can document that, then the site would not be HEPR, even if the construction is complete. You would need to, in that scenario, go back to the determination of human exposure insufficient data. But you would have to have the data to back up that claim. It's not, I wouldn't suggest that as a blanket way to handle emerging contaminants. But if you leave the site as HEPR, it suggests that human exposure is controlled. So if you don't have the data to suggest that it's controlled, then it can't be HEPR. Hope that helps.
All right, absolutely. I think why don't we go ahead and move on. I don't see any other new questions in the queue. So we're at about 1 hour left in today's training.
Okay, and Emmy is going to take it from here.
Sure. So we're going to go over a worksheet that EPA RPMs use when making their human exposure determinations at sites. I realize that this is not readable. In your participant manual, there's a blown-up version of this chart, and we're going to break it down in the next couple of slides. So it's a series of questions, and like I said, flow logic that help answer the question of what should my EID for human exposure at this site. So we start off with question one. Is there sufficient information to make an evaluation of human exposure at the site? Do I have enough data? If the answer is no, well, then you know that you have insufficient data to determine human exposure, HEID. But say you do have sufficient data, you would come down to question two. Next question is, have all long-term human exposure-related cleanup goals been met for the entire site? So you've met all those cleanup goals or cleanup levels identified in a record of decision, for example. If the answer is yes, then your current human exposures are under control and long-term protection has been achieved. And that's where we want all our sites to get eventually, right? But say you're not there yet, and the answer is no. Then you'd come down to question number three, asking, are there complete human exposure pathways between contaminated groundwater, soil, surface water, or air media, and human receptors such that human exposures can reasonably be expected? If the answer is yes, you go to step four, again, saying human exposures can reasonably be accepted. The answer is no, you go to step five. So let's come to the next slide here to step four. You would ask this next question, are there actual or reasonably anticipated human exposures associated with the complete pathways identified in step three? And are they within acceptable limits under current conditions? Again, that word acceptable. So say the answer is no, then your human exposures are not under control. But if the answer is yes, then you would add, again, saying, is it within acceptable limits? No, it is not. Okay, human exposure is not under control. If it is within acceptable limits under current conditions, you go to step number five, and you ask, is it construction complete with the remedy operating as intended, and are there engineering and institutional controls, if required, in place and effective? Because it's not helpful to have an IC that is in place but not effective. So keep that in mind. Say you only meet one of this criteria. Okay, one or not all, but some, then your current human exposure under control. But if you can meet all of these criteria, then you can say, yes, current human exposures are under control and protective remedies are in place. So that's the status you would have while, say, there's long-term O&M for a groundwater remedy happening, and you're still waiting to meet those cleanup levels. But for now, protective remedies are in place. That's when you would use that status. And again, that's the flow logic that helps you go through determining what EI you should have for your site. I'll pause for a second, see if there's any questions that came in on that, because our next activity is going to be doing an emerging contaminant exercise. I know we've had a number of questions come in about, well, what do I do if I have PFAS or PFOA at my site? So I'm hoping this group exercise will help everyone better understand that. But Jean, did we have any other questions before we jump into this?
So, Emmy, I'm seeing a question in here about sites that are not under control, and they wonder if there should be a date when the site will be brought under control? So, like, what other factors do they need to consider when determining when they can actually list it as under control?
So when you're looking at that, I imagine for most sites, there's probably a broader site management plan or some sort of goal for completing cleanup at that site. For federal facilities, that might be laid out in milestones associated with your federal facilities agreement or site management plan, depending how your FFAs are written. So ideally, the date you have identified in your environmental indicator justification language would reflect the overall plan for the site. It might be, say now we're in 2020 and you are not under control for your site pending a groundwater remedy being implemented, you might estimate that we will achieve site under control in 2030 or whatever the appropriate date is. So you would want to look at the broader context of information available for your site to select that date. Hopefully that answers the question.
All right, thanks. And Emmy, I see a number of responses have come into the poll that's now in the lower left about which of the following emerging contaminant situations have you dealt with at a site. And so there are a wide variety of answers. Let's take a look at that distribution. And as I'm scrolling through and looking, it looks like about a third of the audience has faced number C or letter C, where the emerging contaminant is in drinking water wells or reaching the surface water. And then it looks like about 25% have been in situation A, where the situation is unknown as the emerging contaminant was never included in sampling. And then about 20% of the audience is also in either situation B, where the emerging contaminant is monitoring wells, but you're not sure if it's reached the surface water or drinking water, or D, where it's none of the above. So it looks like a big distribution there.
Right. We're all across all of those options, which is good because hopefully this emerging contaminant exercise will help everyone better understand how they can go about making determinations for their sites. And if you're in the group that said, none of the above, I'm not dealing with an emerging contaminant at my site, that's great, but I wouldn't get too comfortable because it may be that the emerging contaminant you may have to deal with just hasn't come to light yet. So still good practice for us to go through this exercise together. And this is going to be, we're asking the same question over three scenarios, and I'll provide that in more detail here. And again, it's really trying to help you understand when do you switch that under control environmental indicator status for human exposure to something else when you're dealing with an emerging contaminant. So imagine, if you will, Superfund Site A. It has a remedial action to address soil and groundwater contamination that's been implemented. Some of your COCs include hexavalent chromium and TCE. The remedy included soil removal, pump and treat for groundwater plumes for that part of the plume that was over risk-based level. Your last EI determination that was done last year was human exposures under control. But it was recently determined that there was historical use of firefighting foam at this site. Monitoring wells were sampled for emerging contaminants, but you haven't gotten the data back yet, and it's just uncertain if emerging contaminants have migrated to drinking water sources. Now, for those of us who do better with graphics versus text, this is the same scenario, just presented in a different form. So you'll see we have site A, here we go, in this blue box. The black dots are your monitoring wells. You have some existing contaminant plumes. Note, off-site, there are some public drinking water supply wells, and then further down gradient, you have some residential homes, and one of them has a private drinking water well. So this is what you have so far. Collected some data, or done some sampling, your data's not back yet, you're not sure what's going on. So given that situation, what human exposure IE determination applies on that scenario? Is it under control, insufficient data, or human exposure not under control? And I'm hoping we can pull up a poll so people can cast their votes. Great, so we see them coming in.
Yep, and for those of you who like to type it into the Q&A window because you're on a mobile device, absolutely go right ahead. And, Emmy, just as a note as well, a number of people typed in that they had been in all of those situations on the earlier poll.
Oh, oh man.
All right.
I can see how that can happen.
Yeah. Well, it looks like in seeing the data as it's coming in, most of the audience, about three-quarters of you, have selected option B, where you would select HEID insufficient data. But about 20% look at option A as a feasible, and then, again, a handful of you have selected option C.
Okay, so let's look at these answers. So we had the most votes for insufficient data, and you could justify this as a status because there's some data for monitoring wells that has come back. You're waiting on more. You know you need to collect more information, so you could select insufficient data, but I would say you could also choose to keep status A of human exposures under control until that data is collected. You could argue that you want to make sure you have sufficient information to trigger that change in your environmental indicator before you go in and pull the trigger and say, oh yeah, we have insufficient data. So I would actually state that either one of those could potentially be argued as a justifiable human exposure EI for this site. There, one other just a side note, especially right now because EPA is tracking human exposure not under control more closely across our sites. If you are going to change from under control to not under control, EPA headquarters is likely going to have a lot of follow-up questions and want to know exactly what's going to be done to get it back to that under control status. So keep that in mind, just something to be aware of. All right, let's move on to the next year in this scenario. So 1 year has passed, and now you have more data, right, for your site. You're back to making your annual EI determination. We do these every year. Your sampling data shows that there are emerging contaminants above risk screening levels in some of your wells, but you don't, and these are the monitoring wells, but you still don't have data for the public drinking water supply wells and that private drinking water well, but you have a plan to go collect that data over the next year. So showing it in a graphic representation here, some monitoring wells don't have the emerging contaminant over risk-based screening levels. Some of them do. You have, let me move this arrow. One well off-site that you sample shows that emerging contaminant is present. Don't know what's going on with the drinking water supply wells and don't know what's going on over here on this private drinking water well. So given this information, I'll ask again, what human exposure EI determination would you select? Is it under control, insufficient data, or not under control? We'll pull up that poll and you'll be able to cast your votes.
And so, Emmy, very quickly, while we're letting people vote on this question, an earlier comment came in, or a clarifying question, wouldn't it be less conservative and a protective action to publicly select HEUC? And I don't know if you can comment on that in the previous example.
Yes, you could just say from that initial information that, yeah, human exposures are not under control at this site. There's an emerging contaminant. We don't know to what extent it has migrated, and we're going to be conservative and say it's not under control. That is an option that can be selected, but you're definitely going to want to have that plan on how to get it back under control by first getting all the sufficient data necessary and what other follow-up actions may be needed to address it so that it's not no longer an issue.
Okay.
So it's that balance between, do I pull the trigger and change it from not under control status to either insufficient data or, I'm sorry, do I pull the trigger from an under control status to insufficient data or not under control, or do I wait until I have solid information where I know and can fully justify this change in the EI? It's subjective. It depends on the site and the site-specific circumstances.
Okay. And now looking back at the question that you posed for slide 39, what human exposure EI determination applies in this example, it looks again like we see about two-thirds of the audience picking option B, where you would select HEID, and then an even sort of split between options A and C, about 17 or 18%. So what's the right answer here?
So here I would argue that insufficient data would be the most appropriate determination to make, because you have some data from the monitoring wells, but you still need to know what's happening in those drinking water wells. So to me, insufficient data would make sense here. And as we just went over, if you wanted to go to not under control, then you could potentially justify that as well. But I wish that this were black and white. I wish it were easy to say, oh, no, absolutely this or absolutely that status, but there actually is a lot of gray space, which is what we're trying to show with these examples. But let's continue on to the next part of the exercise. Maybe it'll be less gray. So say another year has passed and you're making your annual EI determination. Now you have sampling data that shows there's emerging contaminants above the risk screening level in those public drinking water supply wells. And to date, you still haven't been able to access that private well, so you don't know what's happening there. So here in the graphic, again, monitoring wells, the red ones have that emerging contaminant. These orange wells, I'll move the arrow here and here, also have an emerging contaminant above risk screening levels in them. We still don't know what's happening off-site because we have a property owner who doesn't want to let us sample their well. I mean, that happens, right? That happens quite a bit, actually. So now, given all this information, same question. What EI determination would you select here? So hopefully you're getting ready to answer what you would determine for your site. And this is over the course of 3 years, right, as the scenario is laid out. And I can see quite a number of responses coming in for human exposure not under control. And given that there are emerging contaminants in those public drinking water wells, that is a complete pathway. People can reasonably be expected to be exposed through that pathway because it's drinking water wells. Then it would be reasonable to say, man, this human exposure is not under control for this site.
And Emmy, can you confirm, has that third green public well been tested in the diagram?
Yes. Okay. So in this example, we have the data back from the public supply drinking water wells. So we know what's going on with the sampled wells, but we just didn't know what was going on at the residential one, the private drinking water well.
All right. And so, like you were saying, the distribution there was option C. Almost everybody picked select HENC.
Yeah. All right. So I hope that helped illustrate when you pull the trigger, so to speak. I don't know if that's the best phrasing, but when you make the jump, make the change for a site that's under control to either go to insufficient data or when you know you have that complete pathway, that you fully change it to human exposures not under control. I wanted to provide two real-life examples of when a site changed from under control to insufficient data to just help illustrate what sites experience. So here we have an example at Dover Air Force Base. In May of 2019, there was a determination made that there's insufficient information to determine human exposures because PFAS were detected on base. There was a nearby public water supply well that were sampled, and they did not contain PFAS, but there was also an off-base sampling indicated that one private well did have unacceptable levels of PFAS, and so a filtration system was installed there. So based on what they know, they're identifying that we need to get more information. We had limited sampling done in 2016, and there was a plan to move forward with a broader sampling plan in 2019. So I don't believe the data from that is back yet, but they identified we have insufficient data here. And where they did have a potential exposure at that one private well, they took an action to mitigate that. Here's another example. This is at the Aberdeen Proving Ground, where, again, as of May in 2019, there was insufficient data because the facility is undergoing a PASI to determine if PFAS is present in current drinking water sources. So once that additional data becomes available, there'll be sufficient information to make a determination for human exposure EIs at the site. And those are our two real case examples. Hopefully that helped take what we did in the group exercise and plug it into a real life situation. So we'll go ahead and continue on. I'm gonna, unless there's questions, Jean?
And so, Emmy, I think a lot of the questions were coming in on that scenario, but I'll read one here. Are there specific triggers that would prompt changing status outside of annual reviews? Do you wait to update when required annually, even if you know that something has changed before then?
Boone, did you want to answer that?
Sure. We actually would prefer that these statuses can be updated as soon as you feel like you have enough information to make a new determination. It's best to have some kind of document at some point in the cleanup process to rely upon as a data source for that designation change. But to answer your question, no, you do not have to wait for the annual review. It can be done at any point that you feel like you have sufficient data to make that determination.
All right, great. I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and carry on with the next segment.
All right. Thank you, Amy, for clearing up some of that stuff about emerging contaminants. We're going to move on to groundwater migration. And this EI certainly gets less attention than human exposure, but it's still very important. So this indicator is used both to convey information about the level of groundwater contamination and whether the migration of that groundwater is stabilized, including unacceptable discharge into surface water. So just like with the human exposure indicator, this determination must be made with reasonable certainty, and you need to have sufficient data to make a determination, and that needs to be documented as well. You can do this with things like RODs or closeout reports or five-year reviews, but it's handled in a similar way as human exposure, even though it's measuring something else. So before we dive into the details, we're going to do another polling question. So there's just one scenario here, and we're going to see if we can answer this question. And Jean's going to open up those poll responses. So you have three options here.
And so now with that question on the bottom, this is an easier response choice. Is it A, yes, B, no, or C, it depends? And remember, you're only answering one question on the bottom of the slide. And I'm looking at a number of answers coming in. For those of you, again, on mobile devices, you can certainly type it into the chat window if you're unable to see that window. And Boone, as I'm looking at this distribution, they have some clarifying questions here about PFAS.
Sure.
So I'm going to wait, and maybe we'll come back to these later.
Okay.
Because they're sort of setting up site scenarios and then which EI would be appropriate in this site scenario. So I just wanted people
to know.
I'm seeing your questions.
Let's try to answer it based off of what it says here. And we can handle those specific situations later.
So I'm looking at about two-thirds of the audience are saying option A, that yes, groundwater migration is under control. And then about a third say C, it kind of depends, and then a handful of people have said B, no, it's not under control. So Boone, how would you answer this one?
So you could actually argue options A or C here. So if the migration is stabilized, then you could say the groundwater migration is under control. But the stabilization is not explicitly addressed in the situation. So you need that information, because if it's not addressed, then obviously it's, or if it's not, if the migration is not under control, then obviously you would go with a different answer here. But essentially, it looks like they're you know, putting in some kind of remedy to try to treat the groundwater. But again, it's not just that the groundwater is contaminated. You also have to make sure that there's no migration. So it's not just groundwater. It's groundwater migration under control as well. Does anyone have any questions about that?
This is, I mean, just, yeah. If you have a pump and treat happening, but the plume is shrinking, is that still considered migration, or?
That's a great question. So you would need to, in evaluating this, there's certain boundaries within which you want to keep that plume from migrating. So as long as it's not migrating outside of that boundary, then you could say it's under control. So if that plume is already outside of that boundary that you've determined, and it's, even though it may be shrinking, you would still classify it as not under control until it's back within that boundary that you've determined. Are there any other questions about this?
Somebody wanted to know what is, quote, stabilization in this case. I just wanted to know what that phrase meant.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I was alluding to with whether or not that plume of groundwater is within that predetermined boundary that you're monitoring. And so when we say it's stabilized, we mean it's not migrating outside of that boundary.
All right, excellent. Well, I don't see any other questions coming in, so perhaps we can move on.
We will go ahead and kind of cover the different status types. So there are less types than with the human exposure indicator. There's only four types here for groundwater migration. So the first one is GMNA. That's when there's no contaminated groundwater at the site, or where the site conditions don't warrant an investigation or remedy. So that's just GMNA. For insufficient data, you have GMID, and that's, you know, handled in a similar way as the human exposure indicator. And then you also have not under control and under control as the different status types. So for evaluating groundwater migration under control, you need to evaluate these three things. You need to see if there's sufficient data to make a determination in the first place. And then you have to determine whether or not those plumes are expanding outside of those boundaries, whether or not it's quote-unquote stabilized. And then you also need to evaluate if there's any discharge into surface water. So those are the three things to keep in mind when evaluating the groundwater migration indicator and making that determination. So just some further details about this. Again, this is a site-wide status, and so if you have different OUs, you need to take into account all operable units where you have potential contaminated groundwater migrating. One thing to keep in mind, we have a term called monitored natural attenuation, and in some instances, this may be an acceptable remedy, and this is where we kind of just allow the groundwater to cleanse itself over time, as long as it's contained within that boundary. And again, it's very important to always monitor whether or not there's any discharge into surface water. So keep that in mind as well. And so in a similar way that Emmy went through the human exposure checklist, we're going to do that with groundwater migration, just to show you how the RPMs use this as a tool when making this evaluation. So you need to start by asking the question, does the site currently have contaminated groundwater or did site conditions warrant investigation or remediation in the past? If the answer to that is no, then you can go ahead with that first status that we covered of GMNA. It's not a site where there is contaminated groundwater that needs to be monitored. If the answer is yes, then you kind of go through this checklist starting with step one, where you say or where you determine if there's sufficient data to make a determination. And if the answer to that is no, then obviously you come to the site designation of GMID. If the answer is yes, you continue to step two here, and you can ask or you decide if the contamination is above a risk-based levels. And if the answer is no, then it's an acceptable kind of risk level, and then you have groundwater migration under control here. But if the answer to that question is yes, then you proceed to step three. And here you decide if the groundwater plume is stabilized. So obviously, if it's not, then you need to say that the groundwater migration is not under control. If it is, then you continue with the steps, and you arrive at step four. And here you decide if there's discharge into surface water. So if there's not, you can skip step five and go straight to step six. But if there is discharge, then you go to step five here. And then you ask, can the discharge of contaminated groundwater into surface water be shown to be currently acceptable? So this is that other aspect. It's not just the migration of the plume. It's also if it's discharging into surface water. So you need to reevaluate the status based on that condition also. And if the answer is no, then you give it a site status of groundwater migration not controlled. If the answer is yes, you go to step six. And hopefully the answer to step six, will groundwater monitoring be collected to verify that contaminated groundwater has remained within the existing area of contaminated groundwater? Hopefully the answer to that is yes. Hopefully you're doing that monitoring. So if the answer to that is yes, then you can designate the site, the indicator as groundwater migration under control. So hopefully that's kind of a helpful step-by-step process of trying to sort out all of these various conditions that need to be met to help you arrive at the correct determination. So I'll open
hey, Boone.
Up. Sure.
Oh, yeah, well, we're waiting to see if questions came in. I just wanted to talk about something we see very commonly misunderstandings we see at federal facilities. So if you have a very large site and say access to the site is controlled and there's institutional controls in place to ensure that groundwater is not being used for drinking water purposes and that wells aren't implemented. We hear a lot the argument that, well, no one can use the water, so our groundwater migration is under control. So it's challenging to clarify if your plumes are moving across the site, regardless of whether or not there's a fence around it with guards, your migration is still happening. Your groundwater migration is still not under control in that instance.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And that kind of shows how the two indicators kind of tie in together. So, you know, if there's consumption of that contaminated groundwater, then obviously you need to evaluate that when making your human exposure determination. But as Emmy said, if human exposure is not even an element of investigating the groundwater, if it's still migrating, if it's outside of that boundary, if it's discharging into surface water, regardless of if people are coming into contact with it, she's right. You need to say that it's not under control.
Okay, and we had a comment that came in about difficulty distinguishing between GMNA and MNA, because they clarify to say that GMNA being not applicable and MNA is a remedial approach of monitored natural attenuation. So I don't know if you have any comments
right.
or thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, similar acronyms. MNA is not a, I'll go back to the slide where that's mentioned. Monitored natural attenuation is not a, it's not a status for this indicator. But as Jean said, it is a potential remedy to contaminated groundwater. And we just wanted to highlight that because it's a bit counterintuitive that that monitored natural attenuation is a remedy, since there's not anything that we're actually doing other than just making sure that the contaminated groundwater doesn't migrate, and we're letting it naturally over time reduce in contamination. So that's a good point that someone brought up. They are similar sounding acronyms, but the GMNA, I'll go back to that slide, is a status given to sites where there is not any contaminated groundwater of concern. So every site has a status for human exposure. Every site has a status for groundwater migration, even if there's no groundwater migration occurring or contaminated groundwater migration occurring at that site. You give it a status of GMNA. So hopefully that clears that up. But if there's no other questions about groundwater, are there any others that you wanted to mention, Jean?
Not that I see right now. So I think we should carry on in the interest of time. And again, we'll pause again for questions later on.
Okay. And the last topic that we wanted to cover kind of transcends both of these EIs, the human exposure and groundwater migration, and that's the best management practices for EIs. So the BMPs are an EPA internal document that we have for general management practices that all regions are expected to follow, and they each have their own way of approaching these. But essentially, management focuses on EIs is really important. So it's not just a measure that RPMs or EI coordinators such as myself are looking at. We need management, whether that's at headquarters or in the regions, to pay attention to these as well. And EIs should be a big priority for EPA because it's directly related to public safety, and that's of course always a high concern and a high priority. So you heard mentioned earlier for these paragraphs for sites in the human exposure statuses of ID and not controlled, so HEID and HENC. And so each site that has either of those two status designations for human exposure have these written paragraphs that convey information to the public about what's being done at that site and why that site is listed with that specific status. And these are all available on the site profile pages on our website and also on the human exposure dashboard that you saw earlier. So it's important to keep those paragraphs updated because it's a good first source of information. If you're someone that lives in a community where there's a Superfund site nearby and you want to check in on what's being done or what kind of risk you could assume is happening there. Information sharing also is very helpful from a coordination and standardization standpoint. So, you know, we like to keep EIs consistent across the regions and at headquarters so that we, you know, can have a standard for evaluating EIs. And so we need to share that information as best as possible. And it's also important to have an understanding of how the different measures impact each other since they're all somewhat tied together. And by that I mean EIs, the SWARU measure, and the FYR protectiveness determinations. And of course, just with anything that you monitor and evaluate, you need to have quality data. So we're always focusing on updating our data in SIMS and staying on top of that. Are there any questions about the BMPs, the best management practices?
I don't see any questions in the queue, so I think we might go on, but again, we can come back to them should someone be typing up a lengthy one and I see it pop in later.
All right. Well, thank you, Jean. I'm going to hand it back over to Emmy.
Great. Thank you. So we're coming to the last section of our webinar, and this is looking at other CERCLA components. and how EIs and those determinations can affect things like five-year reviews, site-wide ready for anticipated use, or SWARU, which, remember from the beginning of today's talk, is a performance measure for the Superfund program, and even risk determinations and how that is and is not an EI. So let's look a little bit more at how these items are interrelated. So with five-year reviews, new information should be considered as is discovered during that five-year review process. So that could be something like a new exposure pathway, new sources of contamination, emerging contaminants if you have them at your site, or any other evidence or uncertainty with groundwater plume migration. So you can imagine if you have a new exposure pathway, how that might affect your environmental indicator determination for human exposures, or a new source of contamination. Again, does a pathway exist to that? Do you need to look back at your EI? So as this information is looked at in the five-year review process, it also makes sure that you're looking at it during your EI determinations, because while a five-year review happens every 5 years, our EI determinations are made annually. So the other item I touched on was SWARU, site-wide ready for anticipated reuse. And for SWARU, you need to have a human exposure determination that is either protective remedies in place or human health protection achieved. Those are the statuses that are allowed for SWARU. If you have insufficient data, human exposure is not under control, or simply current exposure is under control without that next level of and protective remedies in place or human health protection achieved, then they're not eligible for SWARU. I will clarify, though, I think there's some very recent guidance that was issued just in the past few weeks that talking about some sites and whether them changing a status could affect its SWARU determination. So if people need that link, let us know, and we'll get you the latest on that. But, for example, if you have a protective remedy in place and now you have an emerging contaminant situation and you're realizing, wow, there's really insufficient data for us to know what's happening, we're going to change our EI, human exposure status, and that might mean you have to flip off the switch for your SWARU. And I know there's a lot of hesitation to do that. There's pressure not to do that, potentially from management or EPA headquarters, because we're tracking all of these things. But ultimately, you want to do what's right for your site. If those exposures are happening, or you really don't know if they're happening because you don't have enough information and you need to make that change, then it all comes down to developing that appropriate language to say what's happening at the site and why a change is needed. I'll get off my soapbox on that for a second. And again, just if you have to retract that SWARU designation because of this new information that's come to light, that's okay. It could be information that affects all of these documents, right? You might be doing a five-year review that identifies a new complete exposure pathway, so you have to change your EI from under control to not under control, and then you also have to retract your SWARU determination. So it's really important to be aware of how you can change one item and it affects others. Because we were noting at the headquarters level that five-year review information and EIs were out of step with each other. Or we had SWARU designations for sites that were human exposures not under control. So it starts with being aware that they're interconnected and then making updates as needed to all of these items. The last topic I just wanted to touch on was with EIs and risk determinations. We talked a little bit about this in the beginning of the talk. Remember, EIs are not intended to measure risk the way a baseline risk assessment does. When you're doing your characterization for a site and all the work plans associated with the sampling and information that's going to be considered, that's different, because when you're doing your EI determination, you use the information that's available, but you might not necessarily have an entire work plan to answering all the data questions that you have. And it might be possible to have EIs under control, particularly for human exposure, before a remedy is even selected or fully implemented. As long as those pathways are mitigated, then you might not have all your records of decisions in place when you're making that determination that, you know, your human exposures are under control. And one other clarification, we call it human control because that EI does not consider ecological risk. So just another thing to be aware of. And the last slide we have here, we talked a lot about different guidance documents. The 2008 Superfund EI guidance with human exposure revisions is the one I use most personally, but the 2004 guidance manual is also helpful. If you're looking for information on what kind of language you should use for your environmental indicators, I encourage you to click on the SPIM, the Superfund Program Implementation Manual, because it provides sample language and how you can write those justification paragraphs, which ultimately go into SEMS and then into that public-facing dashboard. So lots of tools available. And again, if you're with EPA or if you're with another agency and you just want to better understand environmental indicators, these are all publicly available, so highly recommend you check them out. And that actually brings us near the end of our talk. We're on the summary slide now. Remember, environmental indicators are designed to communicate tangible progress made in protecting human health and the environment. The human exposure and groundwater migration EIs are reported to Congress, so we want to make sure we have good, accurate data associated with these. But there's a lot of tools and resources that are available to help you make the best EI determination you can for your site. And remember, you can work with your project teams and your EI coordinator if you need assistance. And lastly, don't forget, a change in your EI status could potentially affect your five-year reviews, your SWARUs, and vice versa. So be aware of those relationships. And we'll pause for a second and see if there's any final questions.
Okay. So, Emmy, I do have some questions in the queue. And I'll start with the most recent ones, and then we'll work our way back. So a number of people have asked where they can find the current SWARU guidance. So is there a website or a place where they can get to that guidance?
Let me check. Jean, are we able to send that link out to all the participants later?
We are. We can send it later. I can also send it now. So if you have it and you paste it into the chat, I can get it out to them right now, or I'll get it to them later in a follow-on email.
I will look and try and get it to everybody before we end today's webinar. If not, we'll send it out.
Okay, beautiful. So I'm going to come back to a question that came in earlier about risk communication. And so early on when we were going through scenarios about picking a particular EI or human health exposure status, one of the participants asked, from a risk communication standpoint, wouldn't one want to be more conservative with what EPA knows or doesn't know? From the public standpoint, why would EPA be spending money to sample if it knows that human health is under control? So I'm not sure if anybody can talk about that.
So remember, having human health under control does not mean that you address all the unacceptable risks at that Superfund site. So we want to make sure that those immediate exposures are dealt with as quickly as possible. But ultimately, we're looking under the Superfund program to implement cleanups that are protective of human health and the environment. EIs are just one way for us to measure progress towards that goal, but human exposures under control is not the same as having fully selected a remedy and implemented it until you've identified it as protective remedies in place. So that's just something to keep in mind. They're not quite apples to apples. If EPA has identified a site as human exposures under control, but the remedies for the site haven't been haven't been selected or implemented yet, then there's still reason to spend money on investigating that site and proceeding towards those final cleanup decisions.
Okay, thanks, Emmy. So another question that's come in, there's some concerns that, particularly with the examples, it seems like these statuses are somewhat subjective. And so one attendee wanted to know, how can there be like a comprehensive assessment across sites when their statuses seem to be determined with a bit of variability? And I don't know if you can reflect on that.
I agree, and I can totally acknowledge that there is a lot of subjectivity in these determinations, and a remedial project manager at one site may make a different determination than one at another site. At headquarters, we try and work with our RPMs to ensure we have consistency throughout the program. But remember, CERCLA really is about making site-specific determinations, and that includes what's necessary for environmental indicators. But I agree, there's a lot of gray in these determinations. It's not always black and white, but it is good to rely on those resources, be it your site team or your EI coordinators or EPA headquarters. Boone, for example, it would be a great resource to reach out to if you're not sure what the right fit is for your site.
Right. Thanks, Emmy. Both of us are great resources if you want to reach out. Emmy, you know, works in the Federal Facilities Program. I'm in the Superfund Remediation Program, but we both deal with EIs, you know, for a lot of the same sites often. But I think she makes a good point that there is no one way to make a human exposure determination, for example, and the guidelines that we've laid out are kind of the best way that we've approached how to make this consistent by having these specific things that need to be met. But the way that you meet those and the details that you rely on to meet those different thresholds for different site statuses totally depends on site conditions, and we want the RPMs to have that flexibility to make those decisions based off of the conditions at their sites.
All right, excellent. Could we go back and look at the categories or designations for both EI and human health? Some participants were not quite as familiar with some of those options when we were sort of classifying what the status would be. And so we've had a few people just ask if you could quickly run through a summary of those.
And that was for the human exposure gene or both?
Yeah. Well, they weren't clear, so if we can, why not do both?
We can start with human exposure. That's back on slide 22. See here. All right. So I think, like I said in my presentation, the most basic site status for human exposure is insufficient data. This typically is for sites that are in the earlier stages of their cleanup process, but it could be a designation for sites that have kind of reached these elevated statuses when we have new pathways of concern that need to be investigated. So you can always change these to our sites with these statuses back to IV or to not controlled if you know the site conditions are you know so dire that you don't need to investigate. You know already that the site is not controlled. But then for not under control, you know, that's when you have those completed pathways for human exposure that are unacceptable. And then when you don't have that, you have human exposure under control. And as Amy mentioned, this is for current conditions. So this is before you've reached those construction completion milestones where you have human exposure under control and protective remedy in place, and before the milestone of all the cleanup goals being achieved. So HEPR and HHPA are higher levels of human exposure under control where there's additional thresholds and milestones that need to be met. But these five statuses are the only statuses for human exposure. So every site has to have one of these categorizations. Are there any questions about that?
Okay, I'm not seeing any follow-on questions from that. So if we can quickly go through the other grouping or category for groundwater, we're going to be able to get one more question in before we close out.
Sure. Let's see, what slide was that on? Slide 48.
Okay. It'll
take a little while to get there.
You're almost there.
Okay. So I'll quickly tick through these. There's just four status types for groundwater migration. For GMNA, just think of it like when you put in not applicable in a data entry field. This is for sites that don't have contaminated groundwater. So, you know, every site has to have a status. If there's no contaminated groundwater, then the site gets a status of GMNA. For sites where there is contaminated groundwater, but you need further information to make that determination, you give it a GMID status. And then there's not controlled and under controlled for sites that, you know, fit the criteria that we discussed for those two status types. I hope that is a good kind of quick summary of all the different status types for both indicators. I'd be happy to answer any further questions. And if we kind of run out of time today, I think my contact information and Emmy's contact information is available in the beginning of this presentation if you want to reach out to us.
Okay, great. And I did want to circle back to a sort of subcategory of questions of these site-specific scenarios and when they would change their status. And I think we hit on this in an earlier question, but I want to be sure that we close with this one key concept. Triggers to change the status. Is it only during a five-year review? Is it part of a regular review? Can they change their status when they get new data? So can you just remind the audience, when can they change status?
So I'll start. Yeah, this is Emmy.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, definitely don't wait till only your five-year reviews. EI determinations are made annually. So at a minimum, once per year. Boone, did you want to talk about earlier than once per year?
Sure. So there are we're required to update the status annually, even if that means that the status retains or the site retains the same status. We're just required to go in and make sure that we're, you know, updating that date with any new information. And updating the status as necessary. But at any point in the cleanup process, if you have sufficient data to make a new determination, or if you need sufficient data to investigate any kind of new pathways or any kind of, in the case of groundwater, any new migrating plumes, you know, go ahead and make that status change as soon as possible, as soon as you have that new sufficient information, because we want to get, you know, if there's site-wide changes that are happening, we want to get that information out to the public as soon as possible. So it doesn't have to be at the five-year review. That just is a good time to kind of check back in on sites that have kind of been off our radar, since five-year reviews typically happen at the, you know, towards the end of at the end of the cleanup process, to see if the remedies are working. But for those other sites where there's always work being done continuously, you know, go ahead and make these status changes as soon as you feel like you have sufficient data to back up your new determination. Are there any other questions?
So this is Emmy. I just was following up on that request for the updated fact sheet for ready for reuse and that performance measure. The last one was issued in 2004. The 2020 update should be posted on our EPA website soon. I spoke a little preemptively. I don't think we've uploaded it there, but there will be a 2020 update. So we can share just the SWARU website with today's group, and if you want to click back there, as soon as that update is ready, it should be made available publicly.
All right. Will do, Emmy. Thank you. So I wanted to be sure, before we close out with our final reminders, there were a number of site-specific questions or scenarios that came into the Q&A window. And earlier we had mentioned that the audience could reach out if they had some site-specific questions. So I wanted to be sure that all of the presenters are okay, that the audience, when they have those site-specific questions, can contact you directly.
Sure. This is Emmy and Boone. We're happy to answer questions. I just want to caveat that if it's a site-specific decision, EPA headquarters isn't going to preempt the region. So definitely, if you're not with EPA, hopefully you're engaging with EPA in that conversation. If you are an EPA RPM and you need some help, definitely feel free to reach out to us. We'd be happy to help guide you through the logic in making that determination.
All right.
Yeah, this is Boone. I'm happy to answer any questions. I also want to mention, though, that there are regional EI coordinators who are a great resource as well. If you're an RPM, you should be checking in with them pretty regularly anyways. But you know, they can often answer the same questions as us and may even have a deeper understanding of the sites that that you're working on.
Okay. Well, with that, let's go ahead and close out today's broadcast. We are just coming up on our closing time of 3 p.m. Eastern. So very quickly, I wanted to walk through a few final reminders with the audience. So as we noted earlier, the presentation materials, which come in the form of something called the Participant Manual, are already posted. You'll find it on the Seminar Resources page. Not only does that include presentation materials, but also a whole plethora of notes, links, and additional items are contained in that document. So I strongly encourage you to download a copy of the Participant Manual if you haven't done so. That's still available under Related URLs. It's on the middle right of your screen. Click that URL to select it, and then press the Browse To button to open it. For those of you replaying the recorded version, those links will still work. As noted, we have contact information for our presenters and their slides. It's also on the homepage. Please feel free to reach out with any clarifying questions you may have. And I'd ask each of you to fill out our brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. For those of you who are looking to get a certificate for joining us today to document your participation, you'll get one of those certificates upon submitting your feedback. Please be sure to enter your email address correctly, so look at the form carefully, and then check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the whole session or you replayed the whole recording. As soon as you send that feedback form in, there'll be a view of the certificate that you can then immediately download or print out. We'll also email a copy. So I just encourage you to make sure you enter that information in correctly. If for some reason there was someone with you where you were today who attended with your connection but didn't register individually, they can still submit feedback even without their own registration. So please just be sure to share that link to the feedback form. And remember, if you're playing the recorded version, you can still click those links and replay today's session. And so with that, we did record today's seminar. We should have a recording available to playback on demand in about 1 week. You'll automatically get an email when that archive is available. I wanted to